in a poor place in their treatment, drug tested weekly, we eat the cost of a lot of the drug tests.
Senator Mann, any
Mr. follow-up? Chair, I have many amendments I would like to make to this bill.
Well, Senator Mann, I think this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion, and so I don't know, Senator Hoffman, if you have any comments.
Mr. Chair, I welcome Senator Mann's expertise and passion in helping fix our system of behavioral health. This is one little notch to have the conversation at the table. That's why, you know, I look forward to getting Matt Burdick and his team in here, too, because you're right, Mr. Chair, to Senator Mann's point, it is absolutely the reaction that we saw from our wonderful senator was exactly the reaction we should have, is this is absolutely something that we need to fix. And so I appreciate the committee laying this over for possible inclusion. So,
any other member discussion or questions? Well, with that, we'll lay over Senate file 2488 for possible inclusion in the omnibus. And I think next, okay. I think next up, Senator Hoffman is going to be presenting Senate File 2244 on behalf of Senator Mae Quaid.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I believe Jason Swanson and Lisa Lane are going to be coming to come on up, you guys. And real briefly, I'm the second author on this bill, and so. You know, I would hope that, Mr. Chair, that you and the members of the committee are kind to me as I present this bill. So I'm glad we're laughing. But seriously, this is Senator Mae Quaid. I appreciate her for being the taking lead on this and actually doing a wonderful job. And thinking about her, we just to let her know that we're trying to do the best we can. These programs that are providing meals to older adults are severely underfunded. And they're not meeting the needs of the oldest adults that are living among us, right? Believe it when I tell you that the Minnesota Senior Nutrition Program has not seen an increase in the past 20 years, right? Senator Mann would probably say that's ridiculous. The last 20 years have not seen an increase, while the needs and costs for meals have grown exponentially, and the demand for meals have grown with our senior population. Mr. Chair, did you know 1.3 million seniors in Minnesota exist now over the age of 65, right? That is absolutely beyond. That's a wow. That's the wow factor. And so what we're saying is the access, and according to the Defeat Malnutrition Today, as many as one in two older Americans is at risk for malnutrition. Lack of nutrition puts people at risk for illness, longer lengths of hospital stays, and higher levels of readmissions. Malnutrition is complex and driven by multiple factors, but the lack of access to nutritious meals is a key component. And so meal programs assist in keeping individuals in their homes, which we know is a cost factor in long-term care, right? Home-delivered meals provide older adults with regular in-person visits, and congregate meals create opportunities for gathering with others. While need has been increased for some time during the COVID-19 pandemic, Minnesota has seen a dramatic increase in meal demand and federal dollars to help that demand. But the federal relief is ending, and as it ends, the need for nutritious meals for our seniors still remain, as will the population as it ages. Remember what I said earlier, 1.3 million over the age of 65. So we can and must do better. And so with that, I got Jason Swanson, who is the president of the Minnesota Association area of agencies. Is he going first, by the way?
Yeah, he'll go first.
Yep. All right, so go ahead, Jason.
Great. Perfect. So thank you, Senator Hoffman, and welcome to the committee. Mr. Swanson, please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee. My name is Jason Swanson. I am the president of the Minnesota Association of Area Agencies on Aging, also the executive director for the Minnesota River Area Agencies on Aging. My organization, MNRA, and the other five area agencies on aging administer the federal and state funding for service delivery in our local communities. As a co-chair of the Senior Meals Coalition, I thank you for allowing me to testify today. Today, my comments will focus on the large and growing demand for senior meals and lack of funding for the service today and in the future. Our ask of the legislature is to increase state funding for the senior nutrition program by $20 million. The current funding level, $5.39 million, has not increased, as Chair Hoffman stated, in decades. During the COVID-19 pandemic, federal stimulus dollars encouraged meal providers to conduct outreach and expand. Providers focused on serving their participants of record and were also able to expand to additional older adults in need of food. The fact that the pandemic has ended does not end older adults' need for food. The pandemic exposed greater numbers of isolated and frail seniors living with food insecurity who do not know about home-delivered meals or congregate dining, or who live in areas with minimal or no services. As the federal dollars sunset, we know the affected programs will not be able to maintain even current service levels. This means that the number of meals delivered per week will be reduced. Some participants may no longer be served at all, and new older adults in need will not be added to this program. Expenses are also growing, including the big cost centers, food and labor. The cost of meals and delivery has increased by 26% from 2020 to 2022. We expect that it will continue to increase. Meal providers are responding by serving fewer people or fewer meals per person, with devastating impact on older adults. Lack of funding for basic senior meal service is an urgent need. We ask for your help in solving this problem. By doing so, older adults will not be left without the meals they need to stay in their homes and their communities. The need for home-delivered meals has been accelerating for some time due to the growth in population, and the pandemic put that demand in overdrive. Home-delivered meals is one of the most critical in-home services to support independent living, and we cannot meet that demand today. In 2022, wait lists for meals total over 800 older adults. Funding is needed today to get this vital service to those who are most vulnerable. Lack of food leads to malnutrition, which leads to illness, which leads to falls, hospitalizations. Providing adequate food to low-income and frail seniors helps to avoid unnecessary medical expenses. Now, the question I get asked a lot around this issue is if the numbers in need are inflated due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Well, actually, quite the opposite. While the number of meals per person stayed relatively flat, the demand for new clients broadened and continued while the pandemic subsided. We were able to meet the demand through 2021, but have had to turn people away in need of food in 2022. This will continue in 2023 and beyond. Our providers are well established and have demonstrated that they can respond to service needs if they have resources. The other question I hear is about the amount of increase compared to the current base budget. I do not look at it as a cost, but rather this is an investment. An investment in our older adult population to assist them in maintaining the ability to live in their own homes and to support their health. By providing this foundational service that improves nutrition status and reduces isolation, older adults are more able to take care of themselves and have resources for other basic needs, such as housing and medication. Regular, healthy meals in adequate numbers prevent unnecessary hospital and nursing home stays. Senior meal providers, they are resourceful and draw on volunteers for delivery, and they also deploy innovations for efficiency to meet the medical and cultural needs of clients. The state allocation for senior meals has not increased, as we've said, for decades. I hope that we can be united on resourcing senior meals to support wellness and prevent hunger for our older adult friends, families, and neighbors. With that, I will yield, and I'll turn it over to my colleague, Lisa.
Thank you, Mr. Swanson. Ms. Lane, could you introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the committee. My name is Lisa Lane, and I am the Chief External Affairs Officer for Open Arms of Minnesota. At Open Arms of Minnesota, we are a recipient of funding from Trellis for our senior client meals. For 37 years, Open Arms has been preparing and delivering medically tailored meals to vulnerable, sick, and food insecure Minnesotans with the help of 4,000 plus volunteers. They help us make the meals from scratch in our two kitchens, one in the East Phillips neighborhood of South Minneapolis and our newest kitchen on the west side of St. Paul. We prepare 1.3 million meals per year, and we deliver and ship those meals to thousands of Minnesotans who are living with critical and chronic illnesses. Our clients live with such diseases as cancer, congestive heart failure, HIV, end-stage renal disease, ALS, MS, and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD. Often, they are living with more than one illness, and we provide meals for them and their spousal caregivers. Our team of registered dietitians and trained chefs work together with our team of client service staff and client healthcare providers to deliver our medically tailored and nutritious meals directly to their front doors if they live in the Twin Cities, and we ship them their meals if they live in rural and outstate Minnesota. We provide our clients with meals that are tailored specifically for their illnesses. For instance, a low-salt diet for our clients with cardiac issues and dialysis-friendly diet for our clients with kidney failure. A flavor-neutral diet for our clients undergoing chemotherapy, pureed and soft food diets for our clients having trouble swallowing as a result of ALS, and so on. More than two-thirds of our clients are over the age of 60. Over 80% of them are living with food insecurity and critical illness, and all of them depend on Open Arms because they are simply unable to shop or cook for themselves as a result of reduced income, compromised immune systems, which prohibit them from being out in public settings, and the need for a very specific diet that helps them to appropriately take their medications and find energy for daily life. In the last 2 years, we have responded to a 40% increase in demand statewide, and we know based on the pace of new clients being onboarded, currently 40 new clients a week, that this is just the beginning of an even sharper spike in demand. We've been fortunate to receive state funding through our vital relationship with Trellis and Senior Nutrition Funds and other federal dollars, which have helped thousands of our clients over the age of 60. But as you've heard, it's critical that we continue to invest in nutrition for vulnerable older adults in our community. In fact, without Trellis funding, it's safe to say healthy nutrition for two-thirds of our clients would be at risk. You are hearing today about the essential need in our community to care for our seniors. We'd also like you to hear from the older adults themselves in their own words. From Ed, age 70, who has cancer. I feel blessed that we can be helped by Open Arms. Sometimes seniors can feel that because you're old, no one cares. Open Arms sent us a message. Yes, they do care and they can help. From Ann, age 78, who has MS. Receiving meals from Open Arms always helps me feel supported and less isolated. So appreciative, thank you. I guarantee that without the meals delivered from Open Arms, I would not be as healthy as I still am, and I would never have the energy to shop, prep, or cook my own meals. Can't thank you enough. From Ruth, an 80-year-old with congestive heart failure, as it feels my world is collapsing around me, it is just such an amazing gift to not have to worry about food. Thank you, thank you, thank you. From Sharon, a 72-year-old with breast cancer. You all are like family. This service has been a blessing to not only me, but the whole family. I've learned so much in my nutrition education meetings with dietitians, too. The combination of the food you provide, along with the information you provide, allows me to make sustainable changes in my diet. If you just gave the food, that would be something. But the combination of nutrition education and food means I can keep up healthy eating habits long term. The work you do is tremendous. And one of my personal favorite notes from Bill, 75, suffering from COPD, you've helped me in ways you don't even know how. The food is wonderful and takes the burden off my wife, Julie, who worried constantly about preparing healthy foods for me every day. And I always thought I hated sweet potatoes, so I hadn't tried them in 50 years. I thought I was eating carrots in your meals, but Julie told me they were sweet potatoes. They were so good, and now I tell everyone how much I love sweet potatoes. Investing in senior nutrition helps reduce hospital visits and nursing home admissions. It saves money. It provides hope and comfort for a group of people who often feel forgotten or left behind. Senior nutrition helps people stay in their homes. It provides families more time together. It is not overstating to tell you that senior nutrition really does save lives. On behalf of all of our clients, our staff dedicated to serving them, and our volunteers who give their time to ensure we can nourish our neighbors, thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Lane. And we have a member of the public who'd like to testify, Michael Jones. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Jones. If you would please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
I'm Michael Jones.
Hold on for a second. We're gonna make sure that microphone is working.
I'm Michael Jones. I've been around this place intermittently since 1990 when I was an intern in the House of Representatives for Representative Richard Jefferson from the North Side. And through the many years, I've dealt with a number of different human services issues. Some of them affected me directly, like homicides and violence. And now this food issue. I mean, I'm 61 now. I received some prepackaged meals. Every 2 weeks, we'd get a box of this stuff. So I understand how important this is, because you don't often have the people who can prepare stuff for you, and you don't prepare it, you're not going to eat. You're going to just sit there. Well, in my case, it's probably a good thing, because I'm losing weight. But on the other side of it, I look at, I'm a volunteer social service director of my church, and I see seniors who don't show up or so-and-so, and they're losing, and they're not on a weight loss program. They're just not eating because they don't have it. So I can see the importance of these programs directly. I think there definitely needs to be more money put in this, and we also should make sure that we're able to do it in a way that people will eat the foods that are brought to them. In other words, Minnesota is one of the most diverse communities in the country, but we don't always have diversity in the kinds of foods that we eat that represent the diversity of our population group. And so as we look forward to doing this, we have to deal with it with that issue. What is it? Person-centered planning. Mm-hmm. And I want to make sure that you understand that if people aren't familiar with the food, like what the gentleman or the lady was talking about, they're not going to eat. I don't care whether it's in a box deal or in an assisted living facility. If it's not something you're familiar with, you're not going to eat it. I was in an assisted living facility for 3 years. And one of the gentlemen there and his wife were Jewish. And they had the audacity to serve them pork or not eat. This is unacceptable. We need to make sure that these meals that are served to people taste like the foods that they eat when they grew up. Because as they grow older, they're not going to eat it. And in those situations that I'm describing, that means that they're vulnerable, and it could have a disastrous impact on their lives. So I hope you take very serious these programs, and that you make sure that we take care of the diversity issues in food choices and the cost of those things, as well as we look at the budget. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Any member discussion or questions? Seeing none, Senator Abler.
So, Senator Hoffman, these nutrition programs, would these help people that are stuck in a residential apartment operated by a company that raises rent too much so they can't afford to pay their rent and buy food?
Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chair, and to Senator Abel's point, the unequivocally so, Senator, that they would provide that support on behalf for especially those people that are getting hosed because of the fact that their rent has gone up 12.5% because a company named Dominion has decided to just go ahead and say they can legally do that. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. So Senator, is that to that Chair. Point, Senator Abler.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Abler, follow up.
Senator Hoffman, and to the bill here, thank you so much for your doing to help these people survive in the hand, at the hand, that they're so victimized by the hands of this unethical organization. I appreciate that.
And members, Mr. And
any other member questions or discussion? Senator Hoffman?
So, Mr. Chair, I believe Senator May Quaid, who is the chief author of this bill, it's absolutely, it is good. No, that's good. We're filling in on behalf of her, but she had, in your packets are some letters from folks. And I think, Mr. Chair, we want to lay this one over. Is that what we're doing? Lay it on? So
that's correct. Okay. Thank you. And with that, we'll lay over Senate File 2244 for possible inclusion in the omnibus. Thank you, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you. Oh, thank you, guys. Thank you. Nice job. Nice job. Thank you. Thank you. It's Senator Fateh time, isn't it? Senator Rasmussen, are you still chairing? You want to? All right. Senate File 1637, Senator Fateh, Medical Assistance Income Spend Down Limits for Persons with Disabilities and Persons Age 65 and Older. Cynthia Gallis and Rebecca Preston are joining you as well. And Senator Fateh, you got some amendments you want to take us through or start? Welcome to the committee, your committee.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. First, I think we have the A1 amendment. It's just an amendment that was agreed upon, thus cleaning up some language. And I'd like to move it.
Senator Fateh, the A1 amendment, folks, is sitting in front of you. This is the first stop. It's his author's amendment. Anybody want to drill him on why he's doing it? That's okay. If not, I'll take a motion.
I'll take a motion.
A1 amendment. Senator Fateh moves the A1 amendment. All those members in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. Senator Fateh, back to you.
Thank you. Do I also move the second amendment as well?
So there should be an A2 amendment?
Yep,
is that correct?
I'd like to move the A2 amendment. The one in your packet, I believe, is incorrect. There's a new version.
There's a new version. Well, then let's pass out the new version.
That's going to be passed out.
And then give members time. Why don't you tell us what the A2 amendment new version is doing that you didn't want on the old version?
Yes, I'll defer to Ms. Calais.
So the A2 increases the qualifying asset standard to $20,000 for individuals and $40,000 for married couples. It currently sits at $3,000 for individuals and $6,000 for married couples.
So Ms. Callis, I'm having a hard time. Those mics are not as hot as I'd like them to be. Can you get closer? Because I'm going to blame my drumming, but I could not hear over the loudspeaker what you were saying, and so I apologize. But I would just if you could speak up. Otherwise, if somebody can provide technical assistance and turn these mics up hotter, that would be nicer for me. So go ahead, Ms. Gallis. What were you saying?
The A2 increases the qualifying asset standard to $20,000 for individuals and $40,000 for married couples, which currently sits at $3,000 for individuals and $6,000 for married couples.
Thank you. Members, any questions on that change? I like it. Senator Fatte, you move the A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. Senator Fatte, there's an A3.
We can wait till the very end if that's okay.
Yeah, we can sure do that. So why don't
you
get,
so much.
Get to your bill. Senator Utke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And being we've got the two amendments, if we could just touch on those a hair. As I see them, this is just, you already talked a little bit about increasing the limits, and then the gist of the A1 was to bring in, to eliminate the federal poverty level, and we've talked about the disabilities and the age 65. So they're kind of tying them together is what I see, right?
And Ms. Gallis, do you want to validate? That's exactly, I'm seeing the same thing. Is that true? You can get to Senator Utke on that point.
Yes, correct.
Sounds good.
To your bill.
Yes. Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Mr. Chair, I mean, members. SF 1637 would reduce requirements that impoverish low-income individuals with a disability while bringing more equity to Minnesota's medical assistance program. By first, increasing qualifying income standard to 133% of the federal poverty guideline, or FPG, which is currently at 100%. And second, eliminating or increasing qualifying asset standard to $20,000 for an individual and $40,000 for married couples, which was the previous amendment. And it is currently at $3,000 for individuals and $6,000 for married couples. This bill would overall put more money in people with disabilities' pockets, so that they can get the care they justifiably qualify for. And with that, I'll pass it over to the testifiers. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Cynthia Calais, and I am the Public Policy Coordinator with the Minnesota Brain Injury Alliance. We are a nonprofit aimed at improving supports and services for people with brain injuries. I'm here today to speak in support of Senate File 1637, which is the increase in the medical assistance income and spend down standards for low-income, elderly, and people with disabilities. MA is an essential program that provides medical and long-term care coverage for more than a million Minnesotans. Thank you so much, Chair Hoffman and Senator Fatte, for taking steps to address the inequity in the MA qualifying standards for people with disabilities. As you know, we have been working on this for many years, and progress has been sparse and painfully slow. While this bill may feel like a heavy financial lift as you address many issues this year, however, I'd like to point out that these costs are directly proportional to dollars that we are taking out of people with disabilities' pockets, just so that they can get the care they justifiably qualify for. People with disabilities face many choices. What bills go unpaid? How can they save money or become financially independent? While we don't believe anyone intentionally means to leave low-income elderly or people with disabilities behind in our efforts to improve access to healthcare and community-based services, we do believe that it's time to make these improvements and enhance the quality of life for thousands of Minnesotans who access these services. We are asking people with disabilities to live in poverty with low asset limits we put on them. An individual on MA can only hold on to $3,000 currently. This number has not changed in many years. We are continuing the cycle of poverty that people with disabilities face. Imagine living off of just about $1,200 a month and $3,000 in savings. I imagine that for most of us, this would be nearly impossible. Now is the time to make meaningful changes to the MA program so that people with disabilities can get the home and community-based services that they need without living in poverty. Thank you again for your significant efforts to address inequity in our MA qualifying system. I'm happy to answer any questions, and we'll pass it over to our testifier.
Seeing none, Miss Rebecca Preston, and you know, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and for the record.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Hoffman and members of the committee. Can you hear me?
I can hear you loud and clear, so okay. Thank you.
Okay, well, I have a song I want. No. I'm Rebecca Preston. I live in the Dover Hill Apartments in Golden Valley. I have lived there for almost 7 years. I have a traumatic brain injury that I obtained in 2005 when the car I was driving was T-boned by a drunk driver. Today, I do not have a driver's license. I have severe cognitive disabilities, double vision, concentration issues, and a balance disorder. Because the highway between the two lobes of my brain was severed, I no longer play the piano, write short stories, read fiction, or knit. These things have been very important to me, were very important to me, and I thought I couldn't live without them, but I am. Medical assistance, also known as MA, has and continues to be very important to me. It provides health care and services that allow me to live independently. I have had an independent living skills worker who helped and taught me how to interpret my mail and keep my house organized. She brought me into the community and taught me how to have fun. Since having the TBI, I wasn't and am still not very good at leisure time. I also had an arms worker, adult rehabilitative mental health services. She would talk to me about how my week was and help me to be my own best advocate. She also taught me how to have fun. She went to the first movie that I went to after my accident. I was a little afraid to go very far from home. I have graduated from those two programs, and now I have an in-home worker who is a woman who picks me up and takes me out to the community to run errands and to go shopping. She is also a person who comes over and helps me clean my house, clean and organize my house. She and I laugh a great deal, which is good to have some fun. There is also a driving program at the Courage Center that will assist me in getting my license again. All these things, which are provided by MA, have been very helpful to me, and without them, I'd be living in a bed. Luckily for me, I had a 35-year work history before I was injured, and like many people, paid into Social Security taxes in that 35-year span. This allowed me to qualify for Social Security Disability Insurance, or SSDI, after becoming certified as disabled because of my injury. The problem is that my SSDI income is about $1,300 a month. That puts me over the income limit in the elderly and disabled category for MA. This is the only place where I can get home and community services I was telling you about earlier. This brings me to the spend down, which for me means I must pay $300 of that income back to the state each month to get MA services. That does not leave a whole lot of money to live on. I do want to say thanks so much for improving the spend down situation. When we started, it was 85% or 80% of the FBG, and now it's 100%. Yeah. But it is still money, so I thank you for fixing it, but it's still money that I have to pay in order to qualify for MA services. It still doesn't make sense to me that because I'm disabled now and for the rest of my life, that my income is so limited that it barely pays my rent, and as well as other things that are important to me. The MA income limit for people with brain injury and other disabilities desperately needs to be raised. Please support Senate File 1637 so that I can keep more of my Social Security disability income to pay for my cost of living and get the services and support I need to live independently. in my community. Nobody really thinks much about what could happen to them if they become disabled in an instant. Sorry. Disabled in an instant, like what happened to me. I sure didn't. Nobody wants to need Social Security disability benefits. They've been paying into their whole working life. But if they do need these benefits, it would be nice if the state of Minnesota didn't take part of those benefits away to qualify for MA and other services. I'm sorry, I got kind of emotional. It's so unfair that people with disabilities are expected to live on a very, very low income just to get health care and home and community services they need. Thank you so much, Senator Fattah, for authoring this bill, and I hope you will all support it and do everything you can to get it passed this year. Thank you for listening.
Ms. Preston, thank you for giving us the reality of why we do what we do up here. I appreciate hearing from you, and thank you. Members, any comments? Senator Abler.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I actually have a question for Mr. Monahan. We were really happy to get it up to 100. It took a long time to get to there. And as Ms. Calais mentioned, the cost of the bill is entirely coming off the backs of the people who have nothing.
Correct.
Anyway, so Mr. Monahan, if you don't know the answer, it doesn't matter. But is this got to 133? Is that the end? Is that the highest number that makes sense to do, and then the spend down thing is gone, or is there another number that's the cap, then it stops forever?
Mr. Chair, Senator Abler, the 133 is consistent with the other eligibility categories for MA.
Thank you very much. For people watching, and if you did, so when we did,
yes.
Beginning of time, I don't know when spend down started, but the good news was you could at least be able to make a little bit of money, and then you had to spend down to get all the benefits of medical assistance, which at the time was a good thing because there was nothing, and so that's before my time. But then when the Affordable Care Act came along, if you were simply low income, then you got everything for free. And then the outlier part of the people with disabilities and seniors showed up as glaring, and I'm disappointed we didn't get that done in 2011. Mr. Chair, I wasn't in charge then, so. Or actually, I was.
You were.
I was, so I darn. Anyway, I feel worse even now.
Should we remind him, senators, that he was in charge in 2011, if I remember correctly? We were right here.
We were just hearing that, having a side conversation and such.
Yeah. Senator Abler, I know you're being serious. Thank you. We had to have a little.
But it's just that we couldn't get it done when all the money was being spent on the Affordable Care Act. And so I was very happy that finally, a decade later, like last year or something, we got what we did. So to the members, I hope we can get this done. I know it's expensive. And Senator Utke, I don't know what the fiscal note is, but it'd be worth every penny. Thank you.
Do you know, Senator, is there Senator Fattah? I'll ask the question that Senator Utke would ask. Do we know the fiscal?
It's been requested, Mr. Chair.
It's been requested. Yeah. All right. So I asked the question for you. So you want to go ahead, Senator Utke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Senator Abler had a rough estimate he'd like to share. Is that what I was gathering? You kind of knew what it would be? Oh, okay. I thought you knew what it was, but from past history. But I know it's going to cost. There was another question I was going to ask. The path of this is gets laid over, right, so that all those numbers can come together so that we can see what it is. But it's going to cost money, but this is very important.
Thank you, Senator Utke. And to that point, lay it over. And, those of us that are, have an influence on certain other senators that might perhaps looking at certain ways of getting us some targeted dollars, you might want to pick up the phone or have your neighbors call and say, don't forget about those
vulnerable adults that we're taking care of, children and adults in the Human Services Committee, and specifically here to that point. I would be more than happy if, you know, nod, nod, wink, wink, people out there would pick up the phone and make phone calls to
Mr.
certain
Chair,
people. Yes, Mr. Senator,
but this isn't Abler. This is in the governor's budget, right? He's already taken care of this himself with a $17.6 billion surplus. No?
Senator Abler, you're trying to get... No, that's not true. Yes, oh. Thank you. You're funny.
Would this be a time to do it if we had a little surplus?
He's going to try to get to the point. Yes, I mean, if you look at that, if we had... Just the fact that the underspending... And let me get to this point, Senator Abler, 1.825. No, you brought it up. I am never going to apologize. 30% of our spending in the state of Minnesota really kind of is in this area that we are caring about, right? So just, you know, simple math, what's 30% of the surplus? That's all I'm saying, you know. Be nice if people made phone calls. Senator Matthews, you're looking at me like you have a... No? So, Senator Fate, I think your jurisdiction or your disposition on this bill is we're going to lay this over, correct? All right.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Yes.
Thank you, Senator Fate. And then to Senator Atkey's point, I mean, I'm hoping that we're able to finally address some. This is discrimination at its finest. So I appreciate Ms. Calais for coming up here. And all these years I've known you, I've mispronounced your last name. I'm never going to do that again. So, and Ms. Preston, you did a great job. Thank you. So, Senator Fate, you have Senate File 1015 next.
Yes.
Because we are laying this over 1637. That is correct. Do I have to push the gavel down on that, senators? You know, do I have to go like this? No, I don't have to. It's my gavel. It's all right. Senator Fate, you have no amendments on this. You have Tim Gross and Matt Guidry, and I think Matt's on the Zoom land out there. So do you want to introduce your bill for us, please?
Would you like an amendment, Mr. Chair?
I don't see one. I don't like amendments. Get it right the first time,
yes.
Right? Senator Fazzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. To put it simply, if we as a state of Minnesota value Minnesotans with disabilities living engaged and connected lives, our state set reimbursement rates must be set at a level to pay for the staff supports necessary to make that possible. This is currently not the case, and the workforce crisis is only worsened since we failed to agree to an HHS budget last session. The bill before you proposes changes to the DWRS system, which is the rate-setting system for waiver-funded disability services. Waiver-funded disability services differ from our state's personal care assistance, or PCA program, which is a separate but critical program that provides services to Minnesotans with disabilities who live independently. Waiver-funded disability services include a wide spectrum of residential, employment, day enrichment, and other support services provided by direct support professionals, or DSPs, to help Minnesotans with disabilities to live engaged and connected lives. In 2014, DHS established the DWRS to have a uniform rate-setting methodology statewide, as reimbursement rates varied widely across the state. The rates are now more consistent and are established based on a uniform process. The bill proposes to use more current economic data to inform updates to specific factors included in the DWRS system to help address the workforce shortage. Those factors include those based on standard occupational code data, consumer price index data, and data from the competitive workforce factor analysis carried out by the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Additionally, the bill contains language to address the percentage difference in wages between direct support professional roles and supervisory roles. Lastly, the bill proposes to remove respite services from DWRS system, allowing providers to work with their counties on a rate that better reflects the cost of providing the service, as well as aligning the rate for the employment exploration services with another similar service. Most of us are well aware that our state is in the midst of an incredibly challenging disability service workforce shortage. While this workforce shortage is being experienced by all types of employers across the state, in the space of disability services, the current workforce shortage means that many Minnesotans with disabilities are experiencing less full lives due to the extreme shortage of staff available to provide them the supports to lead the lives they choose. Across the state, group homes are closing. Vital support services for people living independently are going unrendered. And employment and day support programs face long waiting lists as their capacity to serve shrinks. Recent service provider data shows a 30% vacancy rate for DSPs with a turnover rate over 65% for DSPs within the first year of employment. We must increase the state set reimbursement rates to allow for staff wages and benefits that don't fall below those of our local fast food and other entry-level retail work opportunities, as it currently is the case. I would like to thank the group of lawmakers who have joined me as co-authors on this critical legislation, and I ask others to join me in supporting this legislation aimed at improving the lives of Minnesotans who access and provide important disability services. There are currently ongoing conversations with the Department of Human Services regarding the bill language, and we will remain in communication with DHS as this bill advances. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with that, I'll turn it over to the testifiers.
Thank you, Senator Fateh. DWRS conversation, Jim. Did you want to go? Is Matt on Zoom? Do you want to go? You wanted to go, Matt, first, or Mr. Guidry or Mr. Gross? Matt, he's on there. Go ahead.
We'll go on Zoom.
Yes. Can you welcome to the committee?
Thank you. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Matt Guidry. I am the parent of a 31-year-old young man, Caleb, who lives with significant physical and cognitive disabilities and who relies on a web of service supports to live his best life. Thank you for allowing me the time and the technology to share Caleb's story. According to the Minnesota Olmsted Plan, the state of Minnesota should be ensuring that people with disabilities can live, learn, work, and enjoy life alongside everyone else in the community. And I quote directly from our own state's website. But from my experience as a parent, our state is negligent in ensuring these goals. First, Caleb was essentially stuck at home for 3 years when he lost the services of his day program, MSS. MSS was the only place where Caleb can reliably find a social community with his peers on a daily basis. His mental and physical health suffered greatly during this time. Caleb is one of the lucky ones to have been able to return to his day program, but I know there are hundreds of individuals who are still stuck on waiting lists and stuck at home. Then, this past November, the group home where Caleb had lived in community for 13 years was shut down permanently because there was not the staffing to support a safe environment. He lost his home, and more importantly, he lost his community. And from Caleb's perception, I'm sure this closing came without warning and with no apparent cause. One morning, a moving van came, and Caleb and all his belongings were taken to a different home. Now, can you imagine how scary it would be to wake up one morning, suddenly have someone take all your belongings, take you away from your people, and drop you off at a house full of strangers who don't understand you? At the heart of both of these situations, as we've heard, is the egregiously low pay of direct support professionals, or DSPs, who provide every intimate, personal, and medical care in Caleb's life. And every day, they are the ones that ensure Caleb can live his best life. I'm testifying today to urge you to support the Best Life Alliance proposal, Senate File 1015, which is aimed at securing more competitive wages and benefits for all the DSPs in Minnesota. At this same time last year, I testified for this same cause, yet nothing was passed to help. Nothing. Legislators ended the session without passing the much-needed investments, and as legislators sat on their hands, our son lost his home. Our service organizations are losing the ability to provide even the basic supports to the disability community because they can't pay competitive wages. And if action is not taken, the entire service infrastructure will crumble around us. But Caleb's situation doesn't have to be inevitable, and I am here to urge you again to support the Best Life Alliance proposal, Senate File 1015, as it is a needed step towards averting a disaster. Thank you for your time. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Mr. Guidry, for your story, for who you are, and your son, Caleb.
Thank you. Mr. Gross.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Tim Gross. I am the current board president for Residential Services, Inc., RSI as it's called, a nonprofit organization created in 1978. RSI serves adults and children with all disabilities or mental illnesses. RSI operates in 7 counties in East Central and Northeastern Minnesota. They provide a wide variety of services, including group homes, in-home support, employment, housing stabilization, and adult rehabilitation mental health services. RSI would employ 600 people if fully staffed, but this is the problem. That is why I'm here today, to share our staffing crisis and to ask for your support for Senate File 1015, which provides solutions to this industry-wide crisis. Currently, RSI employs only 450 people. RSI has experienced a 31% vacancy rate for our direct support professional positions. These frontline workers provide for the daily needs and services to our clients. These are demanding, high-stress jobs that are directly attributed to the success of meeting the goals of our clients we serve. Due to staffing shortages, RSI has had to close 5 home programs over the past 18 months. 2 have been reopened after being repurposed to serve children with complex needs. These openings were only made possible after receiving rate exceptions, allowing higher wages to be paid to these employees. Currently, we have 3 homes still sitting empty due to the lack of staffing. In January, RSI's board made the difficult decision to raise wages for DSP despite expecting the result of a financial loss of over $1 million this year. Without adequate rates based on the most current Bureau of Labor Statistics wage data, homes and companies will be forced to close. I have described the crisis from the point of view of the industry and an individual company providing these necessary and critical services, but let me share how this crisis is affecting individuals receiving services from RSI. My adult son is 33 years old and has Down syndrome. He has been living in his own apartment for the past 5 years. He receives in-home care, employment support, and community connection and outreach services from RSI. My son works at TJ Maxx and volunteers at the Hermantown Hockey Rink, the Duluth Huskies baseball team, Hermantown High School, and soon a local TV station with hope that this community outreach leads to natural community support and employment opportunities. The goal is for him to achieve a life of independence. We have made great strides over the past year with the use of a technology that is reducing his dependence on staff. And if you would ask him, his pride shines in the possible future that is ahead of him. All provided by RSI, this industry, and the support of this legislature, and all Minnesotans have offered. I am so incredibly grateful. But my son's goal of independence is being placed at a risk due to lack of staffing. At one point this year, we just had 1 part-time staff available for my son's program. A program when fully staffed would include 4 people, 1 full-time and 3 part-time employees. Adding to this shortage, over the past 2 years, we have experienced a 200% turnover rate for his staffing of his program. This is directly attributed to the staff not being paid a competitive wage. RSI is losing staff and not recruiting at the rate needed because the pool of candidates can make similar or more pay at jobs that include less stress and commitment. For example, fast food establishments, or may I dare say, the convenience store industry. How is the staffing crisis affecting my son and our family? Briefly, I've highlighted a few areas of examples. 1, Ben has experienced a whirlwind of people entering and exiting his life because of staff turnover. Staff are not just his caregivers, but friends. Imagine the conversation I'm forced to have with my son when another staff leaves his life. A lack of continuity is a second point I'd like to make in his care. The starting and stopping and constant retraining of staff, basic care items are being lost. 3, missing work, he has missed work due to lack of staffing support. That's the key to independence and self-worth for him. He's also lost community connections and volunteering opportunities because of lack of staffing supporting these services. He's also experienced a life turned upside down for Ben and our family when we have to unexpectedly cover for unfilled staffing hours and shifts. I'll give you a quick example that happened a few weeks ago. I had gone to bed And as an older person, I had to get up in the middle of the night and check my phone at 3 in the morning, and I had a text after I had gone to bed that we had no staffing for my son at 8:30 in the morning, and I live 2 hours away from my son in Duluth. So I immediately got dressed, drove to Duluth in the middle of the night, picked him up, and brought him here to the Capitol where I work. And he does mention to me that my job is very boring, but you know, the end result is that not only the driving in the middle of the night for 4 hours and getting here to work, but also the change in his schedule. He missed his volunteering work that day and his job, and that jeopardizes his employment. And these are things that are really affecting his life daily. Finally, I'd just like to say there's the real possibility of Ben's program being terminated and having to move back at home with his family. I share this story because of the great pride and the strides we have made to reach my son's goals for a life of independence, and the threat of losing all that we have then achieved because of the staffing crisis we are experiencing. Please help my son and thousands of people like him across Minnesota and support Senate File 1015 to help address the staffing crisis in this industry. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I thank you for your time and stand for questions.
Mr. Gross, thank you. Senator Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate Senator Fate bringing this bill and for the testifiers' stories. I just wanted to share a note that I had received from Productive Alternatives, which is a disability service provider in the area that I represent that does phenomenal work with individuals with developmental disabilities. And they say that in all seven communities in which they operate, they have a waiting list. And so they have individuals with developmental disabilities who would like to receive these services that are unable to right now, and we're just not meeting our obligation to those communities and to those individuals. And so I think this is a really important bill that we have urgency on getting passed, and so I appreciate Mr. Chair, you hearing the bill, and Senator Fate for your advocacy, and I'm very supportive of getting this done.
Senator Fate, thumbs up. Mr. Gross, thank you. Senator Rasmussen, thank you. This is why we do what we do. Now we just gotta, you know, it'd be nice if maybe some people out in the audience would start emailing certain legislators and maybe the governor and people just to say, hey, don't forget about human services, you know, 30% equals X, you know, kind of thing. That would be, not that I would keep doing that, but I need this to be a broken record because Senator Fate, absolutely, how can you not be emotionally moved by the fact that this is what we want to do, but absolutely, we're not be able to do it because of this factor, right, Senator Fate? So thank you for bringing these bills, and I know the same thing. We're going to lay this one over too, yeah, in the hopes that who's ever listening, make sure our target numbers are where they should be. Anybody want to make phone calls and write their legislators? I'd be more than happy to say go do it. So do that. Fateh, we'll lay this one over. That's good. Senate File 1009, your integrated community supports. You got. Wow, you're bringing a powerhouse. You got Ken Brents and Josh Berg. I think members get geared up to ask these two lots of big questions. So Senator Fateh, you know, Senate File 1009, Matt Burdick has indicated you guys are doing some work together, that there's going to be some continued conversation with the department about. I love it. Anytime we start talking about integrated community supports, you get into the 144G, you're starting to get into worlds. It's like, I'm glad to hear, you know, when Matt Burdick says, yep, we're all working together and let's all keep working together. So I applaud you guys, you three and the four, whoever else needs to be in there. So Senator Fateh, do you have any amendments on this one?
I don't believe so.
No, you don't. Yeah, I know. I was just trying
again,
to
again, I can
get
offer
you.
Another
That's
one
good.
If you'd like, Mr.
Don't
Chair.
Don't offer one. That was funny. Senator Abel will do it. Senate File 1009, it's your committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Integrated Community Supports, or ICS, is a new service under Minnesota's disability waivers that first became available in 2021. It was introduced as part of phase one of Waiver Reimagined. Conceptually, it is designed to provide one-to-one training and support to meet a person's assessed needs and goals and skills such as community participation, health, safety, and wellness, household management, and adaptive skills. ICS must be provided in unlicensed, provider-controlled community settings, such as an apartment in a multi-unit building or out in the community. Before Waiver Reimagined simplified the service menu, other effective service models existed for supported apartment settings, such as Supportive Living Services, or SLS. SLS was available as a daily rate service and contain the same framework components as adult foster care, such as flexible, shared, and individual hours for awake, asleep, and remote staffing, nursing, and transportation. The ability to utilize these flexible framework components is what has historically allowed supported apartment programs to customize services while meeting the intermittent support needs of each person in the program. ICS became available for people on the brain injury and CADI waivers in 2021, and for people on the CAC and DD waivers as of January 1st of this year. The transition to ICS is not going smoothly. Some providers have decided to not participate in ICS, resulting in service termination for the individuals they were supporting. Other providers are still trying to determine if they can reasonably continue to meet people's identified needs while remaining fiscally viable, or if ICS will become too much of a financial and operational drain on their resources. For the individuals, the choices they will be left with seem to be to change providers or move to a different and perhaps less independent setting, or keep their apartment and their provider and purchase the other services like nursing and transportation on the open market. None of these choices are ideal, and the best solution is to make changes to ICS in statute. SF 1009 modifies the ICS service by giving providers more flexibility in how it is delivered and allowing ICS providers to deliver the same range of supported services previously allowed under the SLS framework. I would like to turn to my testifiers to further explain this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Fatte. Thanks for bringing this bill. Good works. Mr. Bentz, Mr. Berg, who's going first? Mr. Bentz.
Good afternoon, Chair Hoffman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ken Bentz. I am the Director of Research Analysis and Policy for ARM, an association dedicated to leading the advancement of home and community-based services and supporting over 160 residential services providers across the state. Thank you to Senator Fatte for bringing this bill and to Senators Hoffman and Abler for signing on as co-authors. Senator Fatte did a nice job of introducing the purpose of this bill. The vision of ICS is to provide another option to the continuum of living arrangements available to people who want a greater degree of independence than a community residential setting affords, but still require supportive services up to 24 hours per day. And we agree with this vision. As ICS has been rolling out in two waivers over the past 2 years, following a structure that was developed between 2016 and 2019, our providers see opportunities to improve the structure of the service to allow more flexibility and efficiency in supporting apartment living with a level of support specified in each person's assessed need and support plan. I'm going to briefly go into some of the, and I emphasize briefly, go into some of the technical details. There's more detail in the written testimony that you have in your packet that we submitted. What this bill would do is allow an ICS provider to deliver service in more than one building in a multi-building apartment complex, change existing restrictions to allow multiple ICS providers to operate in a multi-unit complex, or multi-unit building, excuse me, subject to department review, and change the minimum size of an ICS setting from 3 units to 2, so to allow duplexes. Especially in cases where people have been successfully supported in apartments for many years, the existing restrictions regarding apartment complexes have proven to be unworkable and will lead to people either having to move into another apartment, either all in one building of a complex, or a different location altogether. And we all know that finding apartments that are affordable can be very challenging, or they may have to move to a less independent setting that they may not want to. We're trying to be careful through this bill to ensure that settings are not isolating while allowing more than one provider to deliver ICS and other residential waiver services, such as customized living and community residential services, in the same building or complex. And it would expand housing options by expanding an individual's choice of providers. With the severe staffing shortage and housing shortages that you've heard much about, impacting all sectors of our state's economy, we believe that removing these restrictions would allow more people to access the benefits of ICS in a more cost-effective manner. Finally, and last but not least, this bill would modify the rate structure of the ICS to more closely emulate the former SLS service by allowing ICS providers to provide the appropriate level of support, including more shared staffing, nursing, and transportation, to reduce isolation and promote community integration. As in all waiver services, the formal assessment and service planning process determines the level of support a person is eligible for. This bill would allow the individuals to have greater choice of providers from which they receive their services by allowing the ICS provider to provide these ancillary services as opposed to prohibiting them from being an option as the service is currently structured. This time I'd like you to hear from a service provider, and so I will turn the microphone over to the other testifier.
Mr. Berg, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I just wanted to take a minute. My name is Josh Berg with Accessible Space, and I would be remiss not to comment on the previous bills heard. I know it's a little latitude here, but Senate File 2244, I sit on the board of Trellis, so thank you for considering the Senior Mills bill that was proposed, and Senate File 1637 and 1015. I mean, not only did it bring tears to my eyes from the testifiers, but these would be very meaningful and impactful bills and improvements to all the residents living in the settings that we serve. So kudos to the lineup today. On to this Senate file, 1009, speaking from the perspective of a formerly customized living provider in these settings. So Mr. Bentz talked about SLS. I'm speaking from ASI providing customized living services in apartment settings that we are now providing ICS services to the same residents. We transitioned 8 of our communities over to ICS over the last 7 months or so, have successfully done so, worked with the department. Shout out to Matt and team and provider enrollment and licensing for helping us jump through all the hoops and get things done. I am a major champion for ICS, and I think this is a program that can help us serve folks into the future, low-income folks, individuals with disabilities, in the settings that they choose. So I am here fully supporting the program. Now, that doesn't mean that there's not some tweaks that can be made, and I think there's some areas that we've identified, and Ken had mentioned over the last couple years of initial rollout, we've identified some areas that could be improved or considered to make it even more viable and get more providers on board. The component that I'm most interested in, along with the transportation and the multiple providers to allow for choice, is the nursing component. Coming from customized living, similarly perhaps from the SLS side, we were reimbursed for nursing services fully and completely. Now, it was a little bit different because we were providing services under our comprehensive home care license under 144A, so there was some required 14 and 90-day assessments and some clinical oversight. But due to the clientele and or the residents that we serve and the complex healthcare needs that they have, we are going to continue with our nursing services because it's best practice and it's absolutely required to be able to meet their needs. So that means, you know, at this point in time, we're carrying about $400,000 to $500,000 a year in nursing support for our clients that we will not see a dime back for. Even though there are requirements in 245D that require some of that nursing oversight, training, supervision of staff. So this is one major piece to the ICS framework that I think is an easy win. It's an easy victory. It's not fixing the whole thing or blowing it up. It's just making it better and hopefully allowing more programs with less diversity in the amount of services that they provide to be able to jump in and make this a good program. So I don't know what else to say.
Thank you, Senator Fateh. I remember when you had this was 2 years ago, you're sitting down Senator Abler and you're like, you were rattling off these things. And I remember him saying, go understand this, go work on it, right? All these that you're bringing forward. I thank you for doing that. Yeah. And I understand, and thank you to hear. You're absolutely right. You know, the only way to do a full systems change is to get everybody in there, and, you know, Matt Burdick and team are, you know, going to be providing technical assistance, and are and still will be. So, you know, hopefully by the time we all come together at the end that we got some good things happening. So, Mr. Bentz, Mr. Berg, I appreciate you two very much. Any questions for – pick their brains. One was a Medica. This guy, I knew him 20 years ago. He was like – can I name the company you worked at?
I just did.
And the other one, he's an old bureaucrat. So if you want to, like, you know, try to stump the two – the Bergs and Bences up there. That would be fun. So, Senator Abler.
Just the more preferred term is longtime bureaucrat.
Long-time?
Not old bureaucrat. Okay. Anyway, so just Senator Fateh and others, let's see if we can't get something done here. That would be awesome. Thanks.
Thank you.
To that point, thank you. Anybody else? We're laying this over to?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, too, for all your work throughout the years. I appreciate that. Thank you, Senator Fateh. We'll lay this one over. And next up is Senate File 654, Senator Fateh, your access to shared services under home and community-based services, waiver expansion. And you got a couple of folks. You got Susan Kane. I think I see her on her. There you are. Hi, Susan. And then you have Jason Bloomquist as well, correct, Senator Fateh?
Yes,
Mr. Chair. Senator Fateh. I think there's an this one, there's an A2 amendment, correct?
A2 or A1? A2, yes. Is it A1 or A2? A2. There's an A2 amendment.
Thank you, members. Yes. You got, is it in front of everybody? There's a lot of words on this one, Senator. First stop, A2 amendment. Senator Fateh, everybody's got it. Moves your A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. Senator Fateh. Mr. Senator Utke.
If he would, Senator Fateh, with an amendment of this size, if you could.
Yeah, I was going to give a little explanation.
Address that so we know what we all just. Approved.
That's such a great point. I was expecting. I looked over at Senator Abler, and I was, you know, going to wait on that. And so I'm glad you brought that up. And yes, Senator Fateh, what'd you do different on this one?
So the A2 amendment incorporates.
Thank you.
Thank you. It incorporates technical assistance from the Department of Human Services to ensure it is operational and makes clear what settings shared services would be allowed. So that's the A2 amendment.
So Senator Fateh, just so I understand. From your original bill, then you went and got ongoing technical assistance. Department of Human Services helped you come up with some of this language, right? Is that correct?
To make it clear, correct.
Make it clear. That's good. And then I also understand Matt Burdick and team are going to continue helping refine and do some work on this bill as well. Is that as we do the lane over? So, Senator Ecky, does that work? Awesome. Thank you, Senator Fateh, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee members. Today I'm here to present Senate File 654, which aims to remove some of the barriers to people choosing to live in their own homes, particularly amidst the current pressing direct care workforce shortage or crisis. The bill does four things. First, it expands options for people who live in their own homes to shared services. This is an important option that would permit more people who live together when they fully agree to share service providers for supports they need. This is a workforce shortage solution that would allow more people to be supported by less staff in their own homes. The bill also makes three changes related to all forms of individualized home supports, otherwise called IHS. For many individuals living in their own home, IHS is a critical service to stabilizing their housing and remaining in the community. The changes to IHS include allowing the unit of service for IHST to be either 1 hour or 15 minutes. Allowing this option would streamline the things on the back end, but have no impact on the flexibility and way people access the service. Second, the bill would allow for indirect billing for IHS. While it is always the first option to directly support individuals accessing services and their goals, there are instances when a staff may need to follow up or coordinate on the client's behalf with their consent. This is modeled after other waiver services that allow for indirect time billing like employment service and positive support services. This is a flexibility that would ensure workers can best support people accessing services on their goals and the type of tasks that help them maintain living in the community. Lastly, this would allow for out-of-state billing for IHS. Currently, CDCS and some home care services have this flexibility, but as you will hear from one of our testifiers today, some people who want to temporarily go out of state with their IHS staff are not allowed to. It is important that people with disabilities can choose who they are supported by if they travel. We have an opportunity here to pass cost-effective direct care workforce crisis solutions that upholds the informed choice of people with disabilities. Upholding and protecting inclusion is of the utmost importance. This bill is one of the many solutions that are needed right now. And now I'll turn over to the testifiers who are joining us via Zoom. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Fateh. And you said a key word, informed choice. That happens to be one of my favorite words in all this discussion. So, Susan Cain, welcome to, it looks like you have, where are you guys at?
We're in our car, sorry.
We're out of state, ironically.
Ironically, not with our daughter, but I thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. It's my husband, Dennis, and I am Susan Cain, and we're the parents of a beautiful young lady named Hannah. Having grown up in the 60s, we have been peripherally aware of state institutions. One of the many fears we had upon realizing the gravity of our daughter Hannah's disability. We, like all parents, were where, how, and where would she live when we were no longer able to care for her? This concern was supplanted by many, many more pressing issues, doctors, therapists, educational systems, and many challenges as she grew to become the vibrant young lady we know today. Many hurdles, both expected and unforeseen, have been encountered and dealt with. But now we find ourselves facing head on in very real time the fear of what is to become of her after we're gone. One of, if not our biggest concern, we thought we dealt with. Housing. Hannah currently lives in her own home. We planned, we worked very hard to save, and we paid for this home. She has staff that comes in and out, assists her with her essential functions, and assures she is safe. To accomplish this staffing, we were forced to switch from the DD waiver using CDCS to DD waiver using IHS. One of the unintended consequences of this is that she is no longer able, and why we're bringing this to your attention, she's no longer able to travel with staff. We've discovered that, according to the law, Hannah cannot have the support staff she needs to travel out of state for vacations. The previous to this change, she was able to bring staff with her when she traveled, and she was free to travel with staff, with or without her family. We always paid for her travel expenses and staff expenses. The waiver just wages for the staff via CDCS, the same as if she was home, simply sitting on her couch. We urge you to adopt Senate File 654 to address this issue. One of our wishes for Hannah would be able to travel with her many cousins and friends that we have fostered relationships throughout her life and into the future. And these cousins and will be her support, her, you know, and be there for her when we are no longer able to care for her, to give her the natural supports to, and only achievable by continuing to be able to travel. It seems obvious to us that IHS services was simply missed, in as many of the other DD waivered services allow travel out of state. Frankly, the way the ruling is worded, the IHS disallows Hannah to be able to go to Wisconsin for lunch, and she lives literally 10 minutes from the border. In short, our fear and our greatest concern is that she will be trapped in her own home, as previous generations may have been trapped in an institution. We do not believe it was the intent of the law when it was written, and indeed contradicts the freedom to travel freely that we all take for granted. Instead, it discriminates against people with disabilities living in their own homes to travel with the supports they need. We respectfully request the law be amended so that Hannah and all of her peers can live the life they deserve, travel if they wish with support staff, and not be restricted by any of the waiver programs. Thank you.
Members, that is, thank you, Keynes, very much. To the point, I don't know if you could tell, there was a few of us up here just shaking our head. You know, we set systems up. Now it's time to really reevaluate why we did it. And you know, you hit it out of the ballpark. Thank you. And I saw you held up, if members saw the picture of their daughter that Mr. Cain held up. So, Senator Abler.
May I add a word or two, please?
Oh, yeah, go ahead. Absolutely.
I just want to, you know, we poured over that letter that my wife read to try and hit the main points. But when we just tuned in a minute ago, I mean, these other issues apply to us, too. All this stuff applies to us, too. And this is just one specific problem we need to deal with. But we're not talking about gallivanting around the world, as my mother would say. We're talking about necessary travel just to maintain these relationships with her cousins, because they are her age and they will be the ones left. And they don't live where she lives. So, you know, it's not a luxury, it's a necessity. And if she can't have her staff with her, she can't go. So it's pretty simple. Thank you very much.
Got it. Thank you. Thank you, Senator Abler.
Well, Ms. Chair, you know how frustrating it is. You go to a meeting as a staff and from the department, perhaps, and you sit through and topics come and go and you don't ever get the chance to talk.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be frustrating?
Very frustrating.
Do you think Ms. Graham wants to come and offer us some insight about this?
I think there's. We had noted that somebody else beforehand that they're working on this with Senator Fonte and will continue. And I just know that, you know, in talking to Mr. Burdick,
she's smiling back there. So
she wants. I mean, if they stand up and come on down and they want to talk about it, they sure can. But I don't think. I think they know Senator Abler. What I know is there's a few bills because the system itself is working and Senator Burdick is working in this case. You should be. I mean, what you had done 2 years ago to Senator Fonte, go work on this stuff, and now what you're seeing in front of us is the stuff he's been working on. And I just absolutely. You know, thank you for
kind of a bipartisan collaboration.
Isn't that scary? That's that Senator. I remember where you two were when you started talking about this stuff, Fateh. I mean, it was just absolutely so. Thank you for doing this, and Senator Abler, thank you for seeing that in others.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. You have a committee budget, and I was talking to some of the staff, and they mentioned if they had a charcuterie board back there, that they would. Be willing to come and spend more time talking to us.
And I'm
like
jumping ahead.
Snacks, you know, crackers.
I know, I'm jumping ahead. I forgot. Jason Blomquist is actually on as well. And Jason, I think you're on. Is he coming? Is he here? Is he on the Zoomer?
We still have work to do. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, too. I was so moved by the Canes. I mean, these are good bills. This is why.
I think.
Is Jason joining us?
Yeah, on Zoom.
Yeah, on Zoom. Yeah. I don't see Jason on Zoom. Oh, there it is. iPhone Jason. There we go. I see it. You wanna turn your? Can we get Jason keyed up?
Can you hear me now, Senator Hoffman?
Yes, I can. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Thank you, and Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to speak today. I'm here to testify on behalf of Senate File 654 and speak about the use of shared services aspect of it. As I did use shared services for over 10 years in Hennepin County, and during that time, I saw many benefits. As a homeowner, it was much easier to meet the demands of paying for a mortgage and other expenses associated with the home ownership. And it gave both of us multiple income streams and made our lives much higher quality, more private and safe and customized our environment to help meet our needs. It allowed for less staff in the house at one time, which, as I said, better protected our privacy and our health. Particularly at this time now, there's COVID-19, so that's one aspect where it can play a big issue. It made it much easier to obtain home care staff because the shared care rates, instead of a one-on-one rate billed at 100%, the shared care rates are billed at 150%, which allowed our staff to make more money, and we were able to keep staff for a longer period of time with much less turnover than what's been talked about in previous testimony. I should also note that it's a money saver to the state, as were you to pay one-on-one separately for two clients, you're effectively paying 200%. With shared care, you're effectively paying 150%, which is a savings to the state, and money being the bottom line of everything, that's of course a no-brainer. And staff also found this arrangement to be advantageous because they could care for two clients in one spot rather than traveling from client to client using gas and incurring vehicle wear and tear, which they do not get reimbursed for in the PCA program. And I should also note, just gave us the freedom to live our lives the way we wanted, which is not always available in group homes and other restrictive types of housing for people with disabilities. Shared care is currently available in the PCA program through consumer-directed community services, or CDCS. I am currently on the CADI waiver, and I use individualized
Is he back on? Is he there?
John, are you able to hear me?
I am, Jason, and, you know, we waited. Good to see you. Good to hear you back. Why don't you kind of take us home and what you want us to know, man, because you know this better than a lot of people, so.
Yes, I will be happy to do that. I'm currently on IHS through the CADI waiver, which is in-home service. I went to that model as a way to bump my PCA wages up to $20 an hour so that I could maintain a qualified and happy staff, which I very much need to do because I am the owner of my home, and so I can't just pick up and leave and going to a group setting or some other setting. And under this program, if I were to choose to have a roommate to help me maintain the bills in my home, I would not be able to do shared care under IHS, as it isn't offered. So it's very important to me and seems to be a no-brainer. As I noted, the cost savings to the state, that this should be offered under all waivers as an option for people to stay in their own homes. And it's a win-win for both sides, and it's something that may not work for everybody, but it needs to be on the table as a viable option for those who choose to use it. There is no problem with switching back to one-on-one care, as I needed to do when myself and my significant other decided to go different ways. It was merely a simple change in the service agreement, and everything went back the way it was. So again, there seems to be no real roadblock to doing it. It's a cost savings and seems to me to be a slam dunk. Thank you.
Slam dunk. I love it, Jason. You just hit it right there. I think I agree with you on that. Senator Abler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And speaking of dunking, the department and Senator Fateh are pretty close, they said. So I just got a text from the department. And so since there wasn't a charcuterie board, they couldn't come down and tell us that in person. But thanks, Mr. Chair.
Senator Fateh, he gets texts. Did Utke get text? Anybody else get a text? Did you get a text? I didn't get a text. Well, he got a text. There you
sure,
go.
Sure, I got a text.
Are we laying this one over, team? I think we're doing the same thing. These are great. Senator Fateh, final comments before we lay over, and then I just want to let folks know. Matt, I think Monday we want to give the department the supplemental budget or the budget bill. What do you think? An hour, you know, Monday with some other bills. Does that work? Okay. Does that make sense, Kevin? Is that fair? I don't know. I'm just thinking about that. If not, you know, we get it. But Senator Fateh, final thoughts.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to all the bills today, you heard from the testifiers what it means to them, the programs, and their families. So I look forward to continuing to work on it with all of you. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Fateh. Members, we'll lay this one over for possible inclusion. Any other comments? Thank you so much. Thank you for everything we're doing. We are adjourned.